Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
In full cry here.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name is Windy, and I'm joined by my sidekick and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Hello, Windy.
And our tactics guy, and a man who is now neck deep in data viz. It's Nathan A. Clark. Hello, Nathan.
Hey, Windy.
You've become a bit of a data visualization expert.
Many years after being lumped in with the data viz bunch, despite doing no work in that area, I finally sort of started programming and I'm getting on really well with it. It turns out it was something that I should have been doing a long time ago.
You had a natural flair for
it all along. I kind of do, to be honest. I wrote three lines the other day that I'm so proud of.
What do they do?
They identify Spurs players. They identify as specific players being coys or not coys, and then conditions their appearance in the visual.
Nice. Okay, that explains the stuff on our midfielders standing out in some of the vizzes you've been looking at. But it turns out Kyobia is pretty good.
No, there's a question about this further down the line.
Okay, I'll save it.
Yeah, I do realise, though, this is just another way for Nathan to throw shade at me all the time.
I'm learning to code just to diss Bardi on the pod.
Exactly. It's amazing. Like, I have a good friend of mine who listens to the pod, Sasha, and he, when I play football against him, he always lifts his game. And when I'm not there, his game is terrible. But when I play, he turns into like Ben Davies. And that's kind of what's happened here.
Oh, so Nathan's terrible unless it's when he's coming for you.
That's kind of the thing, though, right? If people ask me on Twitter, like, what do you think of this? What's this? Can I get your opinion on this? A lot of the time, if I'm still like working towards building something I'm going to put out now, I'll ignore it. But if someone comes at me with something wrong, that's when I'm like, well, here's what I got so far.
Nathan is most tenacious. Yeah. I love it. So we mentioned Literacy Pirates last week, a charity that runs after-school clubs. One of the centres is based in Tottenham, up the road from White Hart Lane. I'm delighted to say that a couple of our listeners got in touch with Literacy Pirates and have volunteered or offered to volunteer, and that's wonderful. They're going to be helping out at the after-school sessions, hopefully. Would love to hear from those people. There were some donations I saw being made as well. So really, really wonderful. Thank you to the Extra Inch community for supporting this excellent charity. That's really fantastic. Also, thank you to That Wasley for the very kind iTunes review, and shout out to Adam for sending us his skip story, which was very, very sweet. And I also want to give a little mention once again to THFC Songs and Spurs Song Sheet, both doing their bit to improve the atmosphere. Give them both a follow on Twitter. They're coming up with some catchy Spurs songs. The Kulusevski. I'm going to say it that way, Nathan, just to please you.
Call him Decky, and then
the Decky. Yeah. The Decky song is a banger, I think.
Unless he changes his shirt number, then we're done for.
That is a good point. It needs to, his shirt number needs to conform with the rhythm of the song. That's for sure. On Patreon this week, we had a very self-indulgent live Q&A hosted by one of our ex-subs. He's had enough publicity this week, so I'm not even going to mention his name. We did it for a laugh. It was a laugh. I think people who aren't in the Discord will find it absolutely bizarre, but it was a lot of fun.
It's an hour-long podcast of in-jokes, essentially.
pretty much. Yeah. There's like a core group of 10 people who really appreciated it. Everyone else is nonplussed. And Nathan, you made a video about Delhi.
Sunk like the Titanic. probably my least well received video ever. I mentioned before
after the move happening. I'd
planned it all out and I'd got the video ready. Like once when we just sold him, there was a big sort of loving all of his highlights going around, people remembering the good times, and I was going to jump in on that. And then my parents got the virus and I was sort of out of commission for 2 weeks, and they came back and everyone's going, this is just really sad, so don't sign up to watch that. You'll break your heart, basically.
Plus it's been proven now he's just not very good. He doesn't even get the Everton team. There you go. I was right all along. I'm waiting for that 50 quid charity donation from Windy to go on my Just Giving page. Can't wait for it.
We do have a Patreon discount on again until the end of February, but since most people will be listening to this probably on the 1st of March, I will leave the discount on for one day longer. So it's 16% off annual subscriptions. If you're interested in joining, patreon.com/theextrainch is where you need to go. So Bardi said pre-recording that he was very, very relieved that we beat Leeds. Because, I mean, we've said this before, when there are two matches in a week and we've lost one of them, we're all just praying for the second one to be a win so that the pod can be a little bit more upbeat. And that is definitely the case in this instance. And we will start with Leeds because it's sort of freshest in the memory.
And happier.
We will touch on the Burnley game for sure. But let's start with Leeds. And let's start where we always do with the team lineups. So we saw some rotation, Bardi. We saw Matt Doherty come in for Emerson Royale. Did you make of that when the team was announced?
I mean, Emerson is in such a funk of form that it wasn't too bad. I mean, maybe a few months ago I would have been quite upset about it, but right now it is what it is. That was okay. Good to see Sessegnon start again, but the best thing for me was Kulusevski starting once again in place of Lucas. I think we can all agree that this is a big plus and this is good for us.
Massive upgrade, to be honest. Lucas was injured for this one, so it wasn't a sort of selection headache as such. That decision was taken out of Conte's hands, but I think Lucas is going to find it very difficult to get back in now that Kulusevski's really been playing fantastically. Nathan, I was very, very pleased to see Sessegnon have a strong first half in particular. I think there's lots to say about this match. You know, Leeds go man for man. We've seen that numerous times. They press intensely. We've seen that numerous times. We've been troubled by it numerous times. In this match, with the way Conte's system is working, Leeds going man for man meant that Luke Ayling was following Son inside a lot of the time. And that left acres of space for Sessegnon to exploit. And on the other side, Firpo was often following Kulusevski, which left plenty of space for Matt Doherty. Do you think that had an impact on the end result, Nathan?
Definitely. But I also think more generally there was a focus towards excluding the wing backs from build up to a greater degree than we've seen recently. Like recently we've had like Emerson Royale especially has been having a hard time being pressed in build up. Receiving half the time like wonky passes from Davinson Sanchez, obviously. But Leeds man marking means that like if you push your wing backs way up away from the back line, then your centre backs aren't going to get sort of closed down from two angles at once because they're going to be, the relevant players are going to be staying back and you can manipulate lead shape to your own design based on that. And Sessegnon and Doherty are two players whose greatest strength is becoming a sort of additional attacker in the box, in sort of slightly different ways, but it definitely made sense for them. I mean, essentially, like this is what we've been saying all along, like Doherty isn't good contributor to midfield play. His crossing is poor, but what he's really good at doing is sort of becoming a third target in the box, becoming an additional threat there. Mm-hmm. And Sessegnon isn't too far removed. I thought he had a sort of more rounded performance. He has some good passing as well on top of that, in many different ways. But more generally about Sessegnon, it's like What was his first game in this run? Who was his first game against?
Can you remember? It was the Wolves game where he got hauled off, wasn't
it? So, oh, yeah. It's okay. So, yeah, he had an awful start. And then what was his second game? Did he...
Man City away.
Okay. So that probably goes down as a better one for him. And then he played against Burnley, which was quite a poor match for him. Obviously, we're going to come on to that. But it's like, it's getting that run of games, you know? It's so far in his Spurs career, pretty much he's come in, he's played well or he's played badly, more often, you know, less good, and then he's back at the team again. And it's clear, everyone has said this now, it's clear that his issue is not his ability, but his mentality, his confidence. And that confidence, okay, it can grow off the back of coming in, playing well for one good game, but what it really needs and what it's really needed all this time, and partly that has required, you know, regular being out for a little bit, is just a run of games. And I think this is the beginning of the fruition of that, which is not to say that, like, if he plays next game, like, he'll be brilliant, right? But it's something that he needs to grow over time with first team football and some encouragement and some faith and some sort of, you know, positive tactical advantages here and there are helpful too.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, he's only played 90 minutes once this season. That was against City. It's been very stop start for him, and like he didn't get his first minutes until Leeds, until with the home the first game of this when we played Leeds. So it has been stop start for him. I understand there's criticism about that. I still think people are judging Sessegnon incorrectly. I still think they're expecting him to be this winger who's just going to kind of whiz past people and do ball skills and the rest of it. So I think he's being judged a little bit harshly, but I would like to see him play a few more minutes now. I think he's young, he's English, you know, he ticks all my boxes anyway. So it's great to start him to start producing something, getting an assist.
Yeah, I think the assist was fantastic, but it was kind of part of a series of excellent bits of play in the first half from Sessegnon. He handled Rafinha really well defensively, I thought, but also he was contributing with excellent running off the ball, as you would expect from him. That's one of his key strengths. And like Nathan said, some nice passes too. He also provided a couple of other crosses. Only one was accurate, I think, but the intention was there. And like Nathan says, Matt Doherty is really strong at arriving in the box. So it was kind of a perfect game for him to get the start in. I was quite happy pre-game with the Doherty-Kulusevski combination against Leeds. I thought it was a really nice game for that combination to be involved in. And I was kind of expecting Kulusevski to be providing a bit more than he did for Doherty. And it just didn't work out that way in the end. But Doherty, aside from the goal that he scored, first goal, he also had that other really good chance when he got on the end of the pass from Kane as well. And unfortunately, his first touches took him a little bit wide, but I think he otherwise probably would have scored that. He did a good job of, you know, trying to lift it over the keeper nonetheless. But that was really, really promising. And I thought, you know, the fact that Conte specifically mentioned post-match that he was really happy that, you know, one wing-back pass into the other resulted in a goal, I think that was very telling. Very, very telling. And I think we might see them get some more game time together as well. I think there's a combination there.
I mean, Leeds were the perfect opponents for us to play. There's a lot to really like about how Leeds play. I do think that perhaps they almost like ideas above their station, the way the system they play and how they play, they just haven't got the players good enough to do it. And I listened to you on All Stats Are We, and I feel a lot of compassion for Leeds, man. I do. I'm quite fond of them. They were like my dad's team when he turned up in England in the 70s. He saw Leeds play at Chelsea, and he's just always been a kind of a semi-Leeds fan. So I've always had a soft spot for him. But yeah, you can't play like that with those individuals.
Mm. They've got dreadful injury problems as well at the moment. They're really suffering from, you know, their three key players, apart from Rafinha, Bamford, Phillips and Liam Cooper all being out injured is a real problem for them. And like you say, the way they play is very exposing when you haven't got that quality on the pitch. You know, especially not having Bamford, I think it's such an issue, not having a striker that can actually keep the ball. Kino says, I don't particularly care anymore about feelings towards him or whether he'll stay or go. But among the best players you see in a Tottenham shirt, where do you rate him? This is about Harry Kane, obviously. Nathan, do you think he's the best you've seen in a Spurs shirt?
Probably. I think if you take like longevity into it, maybe Bale had a better peak. Maybe you think that Modric and Dembele performed different roles to a similar brilliance, but Kane has now done that for just about every season he's played. I don't know how far back you want to take that in Spurs history. I guess Greaves is the only real historical comparison.
Some say Hoddle. Some say Hoddle is okay. Is worth a shout. And obviously it's really difficult for us to comment on Greaves and Hoddle. None of us saw them live. None of us watched full games at the time. So we're very reliant on our parents and people of our parents' age to
might actually
to tell
do
us.
That. By the way, I might interview my dad.
Nice. That would be great. I mean Kane's the best player I've seen in a Spurs shirt. I think he's so Bale and Modric both went off to one of the best clubs in the world at the time, and I think Kane, if he were to leave, would go to one of the best clubs in the world, and I think that speaks volumes. And I think you could have said that about Kane over any of the past five seasons, that were he to leave, it would be to one of the very best clubs in the world. And you know, by dint of the fact that he's carried it on for so long, as you alluded to there, Nathan, I think that makes him the best. It's the longevity. It's not just the longevity, it's the ability of Kane to not only be an elite finisher, but an elite playmaker now as well. He's just an extraordinary, really extraordinary player. I mean, I do feel very lucky that I've sort of lived through the Harry Kane Spurs era. It's been pretty special so far, and long may it continue. Vardy, how about you? Where's your rank?
Yeah, I think the greatest player I've ever seen play for Spurs is probably Gareth Bale, but his time period was maybe 15, 16 months of being like genuine, world-class, incredible, insane things that he did. He was a game changer in the same kind of sense of Harry Kane. Perhaps he was even a little bit more explosive because the goals he would just swing in from far out. I remember the last few games under AVB where the team was an absolute misery and he would just pick it up and just blast it in. Sunderland, Southampton, the end of that reign. West Brom away, the goals he scored against Norwich. So Gareth Bale's probably the best player I've seen, but he was here for such a short period of time. Harry Kane has stretched this out for 7-8 years, and so he probably is the best player just because of that I've seen. Luka Modric deserves a shout because he was brilliant, and the fact that he's still at the top level right now despite his advanced age shows how good he was. And also I'd like to give a little nod to Berbatov, who I thought was a brilliant striker as well. So they're probably the best Spurs players I've seen in my lifetime. I'm kind of too young really to pass comment on Gazza. I saw Gazza in 91 in the cup run, which was incredible. Waddle, I saw Waddle, but it was mostly recorded. So yeah, Kane is the best, followed by Bale, Modric, and then maybe Gazza, Waddle.
He had another really brilliant performance against Leeds. Man of the match, rightly so. Sort of pretty much perfect. A couple of things might have gone better. There was a breakaway where he sort of underhit the cross and it got blocked out. That's about the only thing that I can think of that he didn't do perfectly. He was so good again, so effective. His goal was just, I mean, to be able to watch the ball onto your foot like that, to be aware of the keeper's positioning and just guide it into the far post. I mean, he makes it look easy and it's so difficult to do that. I'm sort of running out of superlatives for Harry Kane.
I think there's also something we need to consider is the timing of the run now, because there was a time in football where you didn't have to get it spot on because VAR wasn't around. So as we saw in the cup final yesterday, the amount of goals disallowed for offside is that discipline and that understanding of when to move. And I think that's what makes Kane probably the best number nine in the world, is because he understands that and he thinks through everything he does. His ability to not stray offside, it's unbelievable. I mean, the goal that got disallowed at Southampton for offside, it wasn't offside. He's really smart at that. And I think modern strikers have to think about so much now. And I think that's why he's the best.
He also plays the pass early enough to avoid Son being offside, you know?
Yeah.
That pass to Son.
Which one, Windy? which of the 10 in the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like that, doesn't it? But this one, I think this one is particularly exquisite because of... So he sort of hits it with his, I guess, the little toe and the next toe along part of his foot.
Okay.
To sort of almost the outside of his foot, but not quite. to sort of put enough... Basically, he makes it go straight, but then it dies just in time to land perfectly onto Son's chest, just over the top of the Leeds defence, and having anticipated the fact that they're all running towards their own goal. It is immaculate. It is perfect. He makes it possible for Son to control it. When you see it from the reverse angle, it looks spectacular. But it's effortless as well. He doesn't look like he even has to try now. He just gets the ball out of his feet and he's got his head up straight away. He doesn't look down at the ball. He just strikes it perfectly right into the path of the player he wants to find. Incredible.
Yeah, he hits it like Federer would hit a shot down to the back end, down to the baseline. There's a brilliant amount of fade on it. It's wonderful.
Absolutely.
John McKenzie, Leeds fan, was in person and came away, you know, unable to not compliment Kane on his brilliance and especially that pass.
Yeah, I mean, that is a common thing when fans get to see Kane in the flesh for the first time. They sort of leave unbelievably impressed. Kane and Son broke the record for goal combinations. Just, again, absolutely remarkable. Two players who understand one another, who compliment one another. The goal breakdown is interesting, though.
I put this in to put a little cat amongst the pigeons.
Go on.
Well, it's two goals under Conte, one under Nuno, 17 goals in 5 seasons under Mauricio Pochettino, and then 17 goals in a season and a half under my former manager. So I think it's all down to Jose. No, he unlocked the magic duo.
I mean, it's sort of difficult to argue with that. The only thing I would say is that it's literally his only route to goal, wasn't it? And you know, why not rely on these two fantastic players, because they are fantastic players.
I do think, obviously I'm being tongue-in-cheeky, but I do think the amount of goals that they've scored under Jose was probably down to the fact that we lost Eriksen, Dele dropped off, and our other goal-scoring routes kind of disappeared. We ended up with a Lucas who doesn't get maybe 4 assists a season and 2 goals. So yeah, we had to rely on those two.
I'm just running a data visualization here, and it says, all 17 of the 17 goals we scored under Jose Mourinho involved Kane and Son.
Nice. I want to give a mention to Kulusevski for his very strong performance again. Terrific goal, really impressive. I don't know what Llorente was doing. I think he was trying to do that skill where you kind of you roll the ball under your foot as you're turning to try and drag it out of Kulusevski's path. Watch it back and watch Llorente and watch what he's doing. It is absolutely bizarre. He could have just cleared the ball. But nonetheless, Kulusevski basically picks the ball up by the corner flag and then a few seconds later he's having a shot from inside the box. It's really
assist.
Impressive.
A Doherty assist, a goal and an assist.
Yeah. He rolls it back to Doherty, who then, plays the assist. Kulusevski is an absolute breath of fresh air. Nathan, are you a fan?
I am. I'm a little fearful of, like, building up too much expectation around, like, the 5 performances he's put in so far have been really, really good. If he remains at that level for the rest of his Spurs career, then, you know, what a player. I'm assuming there's going to be, like, a small dip at some point. You know, maybe you would say, you know, the Burnley game is sort of the lower end of his capabilities. I think if you look at, like, the right-sided combination of Lucas and Emerson Royale, like, Royale, he wants to stay wide, he wants to do quick little combinations, cute interplays, his crossing is all right, you know, sort of one-touch, two-touch football, and having sort of a partner to work with. Lucas wants to receive the ball to feet, deep, turn, take on 12 players, And then you look at the combination of Kulusevski as like a number 10 who wants to drift out wide to where the space is, and Doherty, who's like not a great creative player but will move inside to become a target. Like, there's a much better combination of players there in the latter half. There are things that Lucas can offer better than Kulusevski can. I think generally Kulusevski's tendency to move wide on the ball is not sort of that Conte friendly, but it's definitely working really well for us so far. His sort of pseudo wing back performance against Man City is is definitely sort of the best side of that. But yeah, it's working really well. I really like him. I think Juventus are silly.
Definitely. Jeff Nellison from Chicago has a question for you, Nathan. He says, I noticed after halftime that Sonny was coming in to that number 10 role that Kane usually does in midfield and uses speed and dribbling to make something creative happen a couple of times. Was this just because we were toppling Leeds 3-0, or is this something Conte implemented in order to get some creative spark?
No, this is more like the default of how Conte wants to play the 3-4-3, right? The expectation is that the two number 10s there frequently come towards the play and offer things in that central area. And Son's really struggled with that side of the role, hasn't he? And so in the more recent games, we've leant away from that sort of default and towards, okay, go back to just being a constant threat in behind and don't worry so much about the coming inside and linking play thing. But against a heavily defeated Leeds who are tired and are about to lose their manager and everything else, we got to see that Son maybe can do some things in that position. He's not a complete write-off.
Definitely. And as we've seen before with Son, once he kind of turns and is facing goal, he's very happy to run through the centre of the pitch at defences. In fact, he relishes it.
He loves it, doesn't he?
He really does.
Galloping. And it's not even like a bit of skill. It's not. There's no step overs or anything else like that. He just sidesteps. It's like one of those 8-bit computers with the joystick that you can just move in diagonals. It works for him. Hey, did you see his face though? At the end of the game, he had a proper scratch across his face.
Yeah.
That looked sore.
It did look sore. It definitely did. Bard, you're going to like this one from Fergus McKee. He said, as well as the usual props to Kane's performance, Romero's superior skill and Dyer's big head, please can you devote some time to Ben Maldini Davis, who despite not being in shot, managed to block the shot that obviously Dallas took, having beaten Lloris. I mean, Lloris is a concern at the moment. I'm going to say that right now. But Bardi, give Ben Davis some props.
I mean, there was a time we talked about a lot where Ben was just boiled chicken and veg and he just didn't offer anything. But since he's moved into a back three, there's been a couple of mistakes recently. But other than that, he's been faultless. He's good on the ball. He underlaps well. He supports the other two and he's just brilliant. And I'm not in a rush to replace him. I'm not out there screaming for a new left-sided centre-back. I think he's fine. We can do another year or two or even 4 years with Ben Davis.
Oh my God.
I'm really, really fond of him. And he is my player of the year. Because he was
really?
he was rubbish. Come on. We're talking about like a narrative arc here. And he was dead. We all wanted him gone. Now all of a sudden he's a mainstay. And if Ben Davies is injured, we're in trouble. We're in deep trouble. You realise this?
Yeah, but that's because we haven't got any other left-sided players.
Yeah.
Rather than him being particularly... I mean, don't get me wrong. He's really stepped up and he's played well. I'm still pretty convinced that he's an easy a player we can easily upgrade in the summer, and I think we will. Player of the year is Dyer, sure. I mean, Dyer's been fantastic this season.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, he's been great, but he's not Ben Davies' levels of improvement.
The block was really impressive from Davies. The sort of tenacity for him and Sessegnon to get back and defend that moment was good. I was really pleased with that, but Dallas should have just shot earlier, basically. Had an open goal to roll the ball into and tried to take too many touches, perhaps didn't trust himself. Yeah, it was an interesting moment.
I mean, Lloris had... I used to play in goal, and every now and then in games which were pretty boring, you'd just do something mental just to keep everyone on their toes.
He tried to grab him. He tried to grab his ankle.
Dallas should have just got him sent off, and then we would have had Gallini in goal for a few games. But yeah, it was just a bizarre thing. He was just bored, which is strange considering he was quite busy, actually. But yeah, I don't know what he's doing. And you're right to worry. Since he signed his contract, he started to make really questionable decisions and some big errors.
He's had some rough games. Hopefully that will just be the end of it now. We won't have to worry about it again. But yeah, he's had a couple of iffy performances for sure. I want to mention Romero, but this is, I mean, this will tie into the discussion about Burnley, I think. So what we saw against Burnley was Romero going forward and staying forward, and that continued a couple of times against Leeds. I cannot remember who said it first on Twitter, but someone and I apologize for not crediting you, called him Romero, R-O-A-M-E-R-O. So I'm going with that for now when he does these forward runs. I'm really enjoying his performances.
Mm-hmm.
He's special, isn't he?
We were all like singing his praises in the first half against Burnley, and then the match got much worse, and then he conceded Burnley's goal, and it's kind of soured it. And now I'm afraid to compliment him.
It's still true, Nathan.
He's definitely a
brilliant defender. So he's basically brilliant at everything except one thing, I think, and that is marking from set pieces, where he struggles. Or he certainly struggled against Ben Mee. And then also, this Pascal Strike, is it Pascal? Strike header that he missed early on, that was on Romero as well. But he kind of got blocked off by, I think, possibly Dan James in that instance. So you could perhaps put that one down to sort of good set piece play from Leeds. But I've noticed a couple of times that he doesn't always get up with his man. He doesn't get up early enough with his man from set pieces. So that's just something to keep an eye on.
He's not used to this kind of chucking it in the box, get it in the mix of football. He's from warmer climes, man. He's from Serie A, where things are a little bit more slower, as you like to say, Windy.
Oh, so you're going to agree with me now, are you?
No, I'm just talking about one of your stereotypes of Italian football, that it's too slow and people need to adjust to the pace of the Premier League because it's the best football place in the world.
Oh, I see. So you're going to use it when it suits your argument and dismiss it when it suits mine.
Of course. But I do think criticising a defender for getting done at the back post by a Burnley special in the rain, in the wind, it's kind of harsh.
Yeah, I get it. Let's talk Burnley then. And look, I don't want to say that this wasn't dreadfully disappointing, because it really was dreadfully disappointing after the City game. I fully expected us to beat Burnley. Even at half time, I was pretty happy with how things were going. I was kind of thinking, Burnley have pressed fairly effectively, and yet we've been fairly press resistant, actually, and we coped really well, I thought, with their pressing onslaught. The issue was that we were struggling to create chances against a packed defence, which has been a problem for Spurs for a while. But in my view, certainly it looked like we were getting stronger as the first half went on, and then came out for the start of the second half and looked even better. So I was all ready to go, yeah, see, look, told you so. We did win after all, and everything's fine. And then, of course, Ben Mee nods one in. They did have another good chance from a set piece after that as well. But I've noticed some commentary in the media, actually, that Burnley really pressed us and it was a real issue. Their pressing was a real problem. I didn't think that was the case. It's certainly not in the same way that Southampton was. I mean, that genuinely was a problem for Spurs. We couldn't cope with Southampton's press. Burnley's, I thought, was a little bit more basic. What the problem with Burnley, that we struggle with Burnley, is they funnel you out to the wings and get you to put balls in the box. And then they've got fantastic centre-backs in terms of heading the ball away. And we had Emerson Royale, who, we've all acknowledged is not a good crosser of the ball. And others, Kulusevski was struggling to cross the ball as well. He had lots of crossing opportunities. We just couldn't pick out a man in the box, effectively. Any comments on the Burnley game from either of you?
So we talked about pressing, which is obviously an enormously encompassing term, which accounts for all of defending, basically. So when Southampton, and not alone in that, but when Southampton presses, they're going directly all the way to the centre-backs and looking to create turnovers, and they're going like man for man. They're matching our shape and stuff like that. Whereas what Burnley were doing is that they do commit players up towards the ball, but those players remain quite passive. They're not looking to put in much in the way of actual tackles and interceptions and the like. What they're doing is sort of slowing the progress of the ball. So they pressed in a 4-4-2 shape where they put the two forwards sort of on the two Spurs midfielders. Despite what I just said about man-to-man there, they defend quite zonally and they leave the wings, so the wing-backs are open. So essentially, Burnley did a very good job of forcing our creativity to come through our wing-backs and making things difficult and slow and awkward for our central midfielders. And those are essentially our creative weak points as a team. to an extent, it's always going to be difficult to open up, you know, a strong, mm-hmm. consistent Park bus, but also Burnley had like 3 wins this season so far. Historically, Conte's way of opening up a Park bus is to just go at it with the wing backs for 90 minutes until they collapse under the pressure and to dominate the game. And to try to, and this is what Conte is sort of really exceptional at, is to draw them out into defending higher than they want to by sort of manipulating the ball and pressing triggers and sort of teasing the opposition with the ball so that they come out of their shape a little bit. But Burnley were just so disciplined with their shape, pressing just enough to make things difficult for us without ever committing, you know, any players in front of the ball, really. Mm-hmm. Which again is what they've always been good at. But we are, it is a, you know, a Burnley in the midst of a bad season. And no, I think that, you know, while we remain not great at wing back, this is going to be a weakness. I don't think it undermines the performances either side of it. Yes, to an extent, if you want to zoom out further and you look at Wolves of Southampton, we're sort of a bit of a manic team. Yeah, our performances are very up and down. And Conte, Body, how dramatic are Italians?
Pretty dramatic. Yeah, I have my moments.
which exaggerates how up and down things are, but things are kind of up and down. But I think specifically Burnley, what I mean to say is that, like, this is a weakness that we're facing and we're struggling through now, rather than an inherent weakness of Conte's football or something that I think that we can improve in this specific area. I think that we can become very strong to an extent where surrendering, you know, 70% of the ball against us is a death sentence. At the moment, it's not, and that's partly personnel. It's partly, you know, pre-season. It's partly Conte's, you know, still in his first season, all those kinds of things. But I'm not too concerned about this performance in isolation. It just looks kind of rough when you go, why do we win 4-0? and then 3 days later look like we don't know how, you know, what shape of ball.
Just specifically on Burnley, I do think we were, I know what you, I completely take your point, Nathan, that they've only won a couple of matches all season, whatever, but we played them at a really bad time. This is what Burnley do. They start the season terribly and then they always kick into gear around Christmas or just after and they start picking up points. And this time they've got Weghorst to really help with that, and he's a good player. He's perfectly suited to Burnley. He's, you know, big lad who can hold the ball up and also put the ball in the back of the net when he gets half a chance. So I do think we sort of played, we were unfortunate that we played them at a bad time when they just started to hit some decent form.
I don't disagree with that. I just find it hard to come on this podcast and be like, well, we played, you know, Southampton, they had their best performance of the season, and we played Burnley, they've had one of their best performances of the season. And there's only so many times I feel I can actually say that before I, you know, I start to doubt myself, to be honest. So
I know what you mean. I really do think we can put all three of these defeats down to blips, though. I really do. I mean, just taking, I know you kind of said that if you zoom out, it looks worse. But if you zoom in, Southampton absolutely pressed us impeccably. They'll never have a match like that where they press again for 90 minutes. Wolves caught us out with 2 early mistakes, and Burnley had a, you know, the archetypal wet, windy night in Burnley. Awful, awful weather conditions where they just defended their box brilliantly and scored from a set piece. They Burnley'd us.
I guess the bigger picture, the more important argument is to say, zoom out further and look back to Nuno Ball, or look back to the end under Mourinho, and even kind of before that in a different way. And things are getting better, and there's going to be more stumbling along the way, but things have definitely improved, and the underlying data of how we've improved under Conte is really quite startling. So I don't know. I don't have any fear about us breaking Conte or any of that, or the idea that, like, we're just completely cursed as a club, or that the squad is so bad that there's just, like, we would need 7 years to all of them have to go, you know, that kind of stuff. It's all right. It's all right. It's going to take a bit of time, but it's all right.
It's definitely right. I mean, specifically, Bardi, on the Burnley performance, aside from Romero, you know, showing some really nice play where he brought the ball out and then stayed forward and joined in with some attacks, was there anything that caught your eye as particularly notable, or was it just one to forget?
I think it's definitely one to forget. And there's going to be these games this early in the Conte reign, and at moments where we need, like Nathan says, to be able to build out from the wings and utilise the space they give us down the wings. We just don't have the players quite there yet. Also, we lost Betancourt really early. and I thought he was having a decent game. And I don't think this was.
I thought
he was doing all right. I think his level's better than Winks, and I think Winks coming on hurt us a little bit more. I think we probably might have been able to edge something from this game, but it's Burnley, man, and it's Burnley in the wind and the rain, and it's a bad place to go. And I swear to God, I'm fed up. I'm bored of watching Burnley.
Same.
And I really hope they go down, because I don't know how they put up with it. I couldn't deal with that kind of Aunt Bessie's football all the time. It's too much.
It's just like, it's basically like an FA Cup underdog match, isn't it? Except every week,
twice a week.
Yeah.
for like, how long has he been there? Like 8 years.
And look, that's not snobbery, because Dyche is doing a really good job with the resources tremendous at his disposal. It's incredible what he's achieving, but I wouldn't like to watch it, I must admit. I wouldn't like to. I wouldn't say I would enjoy watching it. They enjoy rattling teams, don't they? I mean, and Spurs were rattled. Yeah. On set pieces, we were rattled. We couldn't cope with their set pieces.
McNeil's got a good left foot. Weghorst, he's an absolute totem pole of a striker. He's like what Patrick Schick should be. He's quite unbelievable. And he was being involved all across the pitch. And yeah, I mean, he's 29 years old, but he's a proper plan B. I'd put him on our bench.
He's decent. He's definitely a decent player. McNeil was fabulous again. He always seems to play well against Spurs, but that's probably because he always seems to play well full stop.
Nick Pope as well. I do like Nick Pope. I think he's pretty. I don't know what his kicking stats are like, but he's just a no nonsense goalkeeper. You wouldn't see him fiddling around the halfway line against Leeds doing that kind of madness.
Agreed. I think we do need to touch on Conte's post match existential crisis.
I'm just going to say I would not be commenting on this. I've made a stand. I've muted all aggregator sites. I've muted all our beat journalists. I'm not going to be commenting on this weekly kind of drama of, is he staying? Is he going? What's happening? What's going on here? And just all these journalists and everybody just waiting for him to say. I don't think there's ever been anyone as psychoanalyzed as this guy before. I mean, there's like dictators in the world trying to blow up other countries, and they don't get the level of intense speculation that Conte does. And so I'm going to stop. I will not talk about Conte's comments ever again.
I mean, a week ago, I agree with you on that completely, but like he hasn't helped himself in that regard, has he?
He absolutely brings it on himself. Absolutely. And this is what I was saying about the transfer stuff that he, you know, this Sky Italia.
He's giving opinions. Like,
but he doesn't need to.
Just otherwise, is what he's going. Oh, but it was a bad one for the fans. Otherwise, he just churns out. He's not going to churn out PR ready, bland, vanilla statements. He's not. Yeah, I'm not. I was going to say something bad. He's not like that. He's not a vanilla outlet of information. He's going to be upset. He's going to be pissed off. He's going to be happy, and that's what it is. And we can't just keep thinking, oh, he's going to leave because he's pissed off at losing to Burnley.
I definitely did like come away from those first match comments being like, well, we definitely need to back him in the summer, which I guess is like that's the entire point, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, I've got no doubt about him staying at the club at all. That he just really keenly feels the losses. He hates to lose, and he wears that on his sleeve. But the way he does it, especially with some of the mistranslations around, you know, when you're speaking in a second language, things can get lost a little bit. It did come across as incredibly neurotic post-Burnley. He's kind of sort of the kind of, well, is it me? Is it me then? Am I the one that's terrible? You know, it's that kind of response. And I don't know. It's a little bit much. It's a little bit much for my taste. But as I said before, I'm gonna continue just to accept whatever he says, because I think he's a brilliant, brilliant manager.
But what do you want him to say? What in an ideal world, Wendy, that you write his script, what do you want him to say after losing that game?
It wasn't necessarily what he says, although in this instance it was. It's sometimes the way he says it. I just want him to be a little bit calmer. A little bit calmer post-match and say, we need to go home and reflect on the performance kind of thing.
Have you seen Antonio?
Well, this
Conte?
Is it. I know he's being himself, but being himself is what has raised everyone's heart rate so much. That's why, you know, the beat journalists will be absolutely loving this, because there's constant stories to write about what he's saying.
Homework for Bardi is to go back and read some post-match comments from Conte at Inter, and maybe even Juve after losses, to see how dramatic he got there before going on, you know, massive win streaks.
Mm.
I mean, Nima slurs into my DMs after big results or big things, and he goes, "How's it going?" I was just like, this is what you get. This is what you get with him." Yep. And we just need to get past this. It's not a shock anymore. This is going to continue to happen. It's not a story.
It's what you get, but it also is a story because he makes it a story.
No, because it's not. This is if something is repeated every single week, it's not a story. That's what I'm trying to say. Is it? If somebody keeps, I can't even think of an analogy to sum this up. So I'm just gonna. If someone continues to get upset about something, that's his behavior. It's not a story. That's just how he is. So just let him be. Just let him be upset when we've been bad. Let him be happy when we've won games. It's not. There's people on Twitter saying he's got bipolar. It's like, who the fuck made you a doctor? And everybody's psychoanalyzing him. Just let him be. Let him manage the club. And you've done really well, because I wasn't going to talk about this. And here I am 5 minutes later shouting at my microphone with a dog looking at me. So I'm not going to talk about it anymore.
Nathan, Tom Hendy says, watching the Burnley game in Australia, our commentary and pre-game were making quite the fuss about Burnley's 4-4-2 and how it will do well to cope with the 3-4-3. They then went on to spend the first half imploring Burnley to hit it long to Weghorst, and belittling our wing backs for not hitting crosses early in the wet and windy conditions, before adding Burnley's centre back love of fending off crosses. Is there a basic tactical mismatch with a 4-4-2 versus 3-4-3, or was this the commentators trying to play footballing hipster?
I don't think that there is a tactical mismatch. Like, again, going back to what I said earlier, is that like Conte's answer to these situations is to just use the wing backs to the highest degree, right? And it's like, if we in that game we didn't have Emerson Royale, we had Achraf Hakimi, like we put three in the first half, and that is as simple as that. So like, there's some truth to what they're saying. They're also saying contradictory things: hit the crosses early, and also Burnley centre backs love fending off crosses. No, I don't think we need to like be afraid of the 4-4-2. It was appropriate in this match under these conditions, and also maximised. I mean, essentially, like, up until the big Burnley chance at the end, not the goal, it was a game with like a handful of shots and less than one expected goal. Mm-hmm. So it was about Burnley making like the game not happen. It's not like we're like undone as a unit by the most common defensive formation. Because again, like most teams, whether they're playing like 4-2-3-1 in position or whatever, most teams defend in a 4-4-2, and also Conte wins most games, right? So, yeah.
Just to add to that, Burnley's 4-4-2 is particularly specific. So they play with incredibly narrow back four, an incredibly narrow midfield four, and then the front two do come back as well and get behind the ball as much as possible. So you're not going to come up against too many 4-4-2s that are that compact, that narrow, and want to force you out to the wings every time. So I think maybe it's just an unfortunate mismatch for Conte against Dyche, in that at the moment with the wingbacks we've got in the form they're in, it's a bit of a problem. Maybe next year, if we've got different wingbacks, things will be different. But I don't think there's anything specific to 4-4-2 that is, like Nathan says, is generally a problem. I think it's just that this Burnley 4-4-2 is difficult for most teams to play against generally, unless they've got incredibly good wingers who deliver pinpoint balls or can cut inside and shoot effectively. I found it an interesting game, but very, very frustrating, particularly as I was expecting to win it, and it kind of, it kills some of my good vibes after City. So then having a comfortable win against Leeds was a wonderful tonic. Itai from Israel says, following this defeat, the Burnley game and blown morale, I'd love to hear your opinions on Oliver Skip. Looking back at the season so far, it seems like the most consistent and determined player we've had has been Skip. Whenever he's played, he's added a ton of energy to our squad and has been a real nuisance to any opposition teams. Are the recent losses related to the fact that Skippy's been injured, and how important could his return be?
I mean, I think Skip has definitely grown in stature since he's been injured. But I don't think it's because... I don't think our losses are anything related to him. Højbjerg has played pretty well in two of the three games that he's started recently. I think our problems against Southampton, Wolves and Burnley are well documented. I don't think it's really centre midfield, although we could always be a bit better there.
Anything to add, Nathan?
I sort of want to avoid Skip discourse right now, to be honest. I I feel a little up in the air about my feelings on this subject. I'm going to be a coward and back out.
I mean, I think Skip is a really good young player.
Yeah.
And I think he's currently basically on a level with our other midfielders. And so I don't think necessarily that his absence had any impact on the losses necessarily. But what I would say is him not being available means that essentially you're restricted in your choices and restricted in the rotation. So it puts more minutes in the legs of players who might otherwise have been rested. And I did think against Burnley that we looked tired. I mean, I often think when people say, oh, Spurs look tired, that's kind of a go-to thing when you're having a bad performance after a good performance. But actually, I really did think we looked tired in the first half, in particular of the Burnley game, probably because they put so much into the City win. And, you know, we didn't do much rotation. And having Skip available to have played in one of them and rotated out either Højbjerg or Winks would have been really, really useful, I think. I think Bentancur is really good. I like him a lot. I didn't think he was that good against Burnley, to be honest. I thought he was getting caught in the ball a bit again, like he did against City. And obviously, what was really positive about his performance against City was his forward pressing was fantastic. And that wouldn't have had the same impact against Burnley, I don't think, had he stayed on. And actually, I thought the best part of the game for us was about the first 15 or 20 minutes of the second half, where I thought Winks was doing a pretty good job. But again, Bentancur being injured is a nightmare because we're down to two fit midfielders right now, and that's going to take its toll. We've seen what happens with Højbjerg when he plays and plays and plays. His performances do eventually drop off. So just having another body there would be really useful at the moment. James says, having time to think about the Burnley result and buoyed by a great first half against Leeds, looking at the stats, we had somewhere between 41 and 45% possession. In the Burnley game, it was 60% plus. I'd be interested to know our record with greater than 60% possession, because I imagine it's abysmal.
Maybe, yeah. I don't know if it's abysmal, but I do think, like, at the moment, we're having a better time when either there's like a more even share of possession, there are spells back and forth, or the other team are having more of the ball. And again, it goes back to like we're just not quite there yet with our individual and collective creativity in terms of breaking open the Parks bus. But again, I think it will come.
Definitely. And I wanted to shout out Matt D, who asked a similar question also about sort of the deep block that we struggle against. One thing I would say is we've now seen a few different automations be successful. So we spoke about the Son run towards the ball and then spinning behind run against City. And then obviously against Leeds, we've seen the both fullbacks attacking at the same time. And actually the thing to note about that goal was Doherty was on his bike, and Nathan made this point that the wingbacks weren't contributing to build up much against Leeds. If you watch that first goal back when we have possession in our back line, Doherty is on his bike pretty quickly, pretty early on in that move. And I think that's notable in the Leeds game for sure. So I'm pretty encouraged that the automations are starting to take effect. One thing I would say is it would be really nice if we could not only concede from set pieces, but score from them as well, because that would take some of the heat off in certain matches. And we've not quite seen the set piece goals that I was expecting to date, which is a little frustrating.
We did hit the bar against Burnley from a set piece.
Remind me, I've wiped it from my memory.
So I think it was Son whipped it in, Kane header. Was it the bar? Pretty sure it was the bar.
I cannot remember that, so it's mad, isn't it? It's only a week ago. And
yeah, I think it was about the 60th minute or so. I haven't watched the highlights back, but I think it was around then.
How much rotation do you think there'll be for the Middlesbrough match?
I think we'll probably see Gallini. I think Lloris needs removing. And he needs to sit down for a little bit. So I think we'll see him. I don't think there'll be much more rotation. Kane will start. Son will maybe Bergwijn will start over Son. But I don't think there'll be a lot of rotation, just because I don't think we have many players to rotate in or out.
I did wonder about Bergwijn. He is someone who hasn't had that many minutes. He looked good when he came on against Leeds, I thought. Looked lively, carried the ball really well. I'd be very much in favour of him starting against Middlesbrough. I'd be in favour of resting Son and Kulusevski, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be fine with that. I don't think we can do a lot of rotation in midfield unless we play Harvey White, which is possible. And then perhaps Reguilón comes back in for Sessegnon to give Sessegnon a bit of a rest, and perhaps Emerson Royal comes back in for Doherty. So some tweaks, yep. Perhaps.
Yeah, I think Conte might have been a bit scared about what happened with Morecambe, so I don't think it would be wholesale. But I have a funny feeling we might see Gallini.
So since we last spoke about the Y World, Spurs have made a statement about wanting to sort of phase out the use of the word. And the response from the fan base has been to sing it more, basically, and to sort of be resistant to that message. I wanted to say a few thank yous, actually, for people who've been in touch with their thoughts on the Y word. So Joe Wagner, Phil Mayo, Alex Klim, Sean, Nathan DePaul, and David Deek. Thank you very much. Nathan, you had some thoughts, I think, on this.
Yeah, it's kind of funny timing that this thing's been. We did a bunch of platforming of various different opinions. I think what we've seen from Spurs recently, and what we showed in the sort of little voice clips that we were putting on the end, is that there's a very diverse opinion from Jewish people. So the majority of Jewish non-Spurs fans are against our use of the word, whereas within the Spurs fan base, it seems sort of pretty significantly split. And I think that basically, as long as this is an issue for Jewish people to sort out and not for non-Jewish people to sort of, have deciding decisions about. I understand both, opinions on this matter, both inside and outside of the fan base. I think everyone has sort of fairly reasoned arguments. You know, the best version of their argument is a reasonable one. But it's for us to stay out of and for Jewish people to discuss it amongst themselves. And I recommend, in the meantime, while the topic remains unsure, that you err on the side of the caution and do the best by the most people you can and avoid using a word that I don't think is ours to use. It is worth pointing out that most of our good songs contain the Y word. A significant number of our best tunes. That is its own sort of separate challenge. Doesn't really change the point, but I do recognize it as a significant inconvenience in this task. But basically, I don't think that we can say much, or other non-Jewish people can say much, or really reach a conclusion. Really, I don't think there is there isn't a discussion for us to have. It's not for us, you know.
It's so complicated. As someone who was at the Wolves game, which was the first game after the statement, the crowd was singing it after 2 minutes, and it was a proper stand of, we're going to sing it and this is our word.
It's always
going to
be that
way.
It's always going to be, anytime that the club tell fans how to behave, there's going to be, that isn't how, it has to come from within the fan base, and it has to come from a sort of collective decision of Jewish Spurs fans about what they want. You're never going to get a total 100% agreement on anything. But it remains their discussion to have, I believe, you know.
I agree with Nathan. I'm also conscious when it's sung now, should I sing it? And I don't know. I can't give an opinion on this either way. It's not for me to give an opinion on it. I will try not to sing it, but yeah, it's such a complicated topic.
I must admit, I'm slightly cynical about the club's reasoning as well.
Of course.
In light of the podcast that Greg Jenner kindly donated to us, go back and listen to that if you haven't already. I think there's some really interesting points, not least that it is a word that is now being exported around the world due to Spurs, and that will no doubt have an impact on Spurs' commercial activity. And I wonder cynically whether that is part of the reason why the club no longer wants the fans to use it. And I don't think the statement was the most effective way of stopping fans from using it. In fact, I think it's more likely to have the opposite effect. You know, we literally have a song that says they tried to stop us and look what it did, which was sung again at the weekend defiantly by Spurs fans and will continue to be until, like Nathan says, Jewish people have a voice and are able to tell us what we need to hear, essentially. But as Nathan points out, it's so mixed amongst Jewish fans as well. There are Jewish fans that we've platformed on this podcast who find comfort in the in the use of the word, and others who find it abhorrent.
And there's
no consensus.
There's no consensus, and there's no way for us to weigh in on that really, other than again to lean towards caution. I think there's a bit of like a chicken and the egg situation where it's like Spurs fans receive anti-Semitic abuse because we use the Y word, and also the other way around. And so the use of the Y word is blamed for, well, not blamed, but recognized as sort of a starting point for us receiving anti-Semitic abuse. Like specifically abroad, again, like you're talking about, like the exportation of the Y word, and therefore that's going to necessarily lead to abuse coming back the other way. I don't know. And again, a return to the same point is that it's just not a discussion to have.
There's absolutely no doubt in my mind that supporters of other clubs who are using the word should not be using the word.
The discussion isn't that. I think that is a consensus. The discussion is, why is the focus on Spurs fans using the word when, you know, West Ham fans are hissing or use it viciously? Yeah. And should there be any concern about us using the word with a positive intention when meanwhile there are like really quite horrific things being sung and done by other fans? I think that is where people feel there's hypocrisy, but I don't think it's as simple as that either.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Ivan Victor says, you probably already answered this when Conte was hired, but what are your expectations for the rest of the season? It's obvious to me that just because we can beat City, it doesn't mean that we'll beat Burnley, as those two games are kind of chalk and cheese. So I expect more highs and lows, glorious sunsets and bumps in the road, and consistency will have to wait for next season. Buddy, what are your hopes for the rest of the season?
I still hope for top four. I don't think it's done yet. I still think there's enough teams in there that will mess up and make mistakes, as we're seeing with United and West Ham and stuff. But I'm not as confident as I was a few weeks ago.
538 are giving us a 19% chance of top four. I'd probably give us 25 to 30% chance, maybe.
That will change dramatically if we beat Arsenal, by the way.
Yeah.
For sure.
All right. Yeah. I'll let you know after that game then.
it will probably swing the opposite way if we were to beat Arsenal. Mm. I'd say that, because they're rated at 60%, I believe, last time I checked.
It's always annoying with Arsenal, but like, they were quite bad for a long time and they amassed points despite it, and now they're in a better place. And it's very frustrating that they survived being as bad as they were and sort of got on all right with it despite that.
I still think they have some tricky fixtures.
They really do.
They've got to go to West Ham, they've got to go to Newcastle, they've got to go to Southampton. They've still got to play Liverpool. I don't think it's done and dusted. It's going to be a few more twists in this, but you're right. Scraping past Wolves, that should have been a draw. And yeah, they still got to play Chelsea as well from the game they missed this weekend. It's not done, but I'm not as confident as I was.
I completely agree with Bardi's point about Arsenal's run of fixtures. They've got a really nasty, nasty run. So they play Liverpool, then away at Villa, which is not an easy game now. Away at Palace, you know, Vieira is doing a really decent job with Palace. They're difficult to beat. Then they're home to Brighton. You know, we've seen Arsenal struggle against Brighton in recent years. They play away at Southampton. Southampton are hitting a decent spell of form. If they can maintain that, then there'll be a potential problem as well. Then they play Man United at home and West Ham away. That's a really, really tricky run. I would say ours is slightly easier than that. Slightly easier than that. Not a huge amount. We still have to play Liverpool too. And we've got other tough games to come also. But if we beat Arsenal and beat United, then I think top four is ours to lose, basically. But they're tough games. Tough games.
I'm sort of less concerned about getting top four than the normal. Obviously, I would like us to be in the Champions League next season, but I think that our player pool with Conte is quite significant. I think that our spending will be significant. Obviously, Champions League will make, you know, a difference to the budget, but it's not back in the days where it's like, if we don't make Champions League, we don't have any cash to spend, right? I don't think it's as bad as that.
I do think it could change the number of players we're able to sign, though.
of course it will help. It'll help. What I'm saying is, like, previously with Spurs, for a lot of the last decade or so, a lot has been pinned on whether or not we hit Champions League. And I don't think that that is, I don't think it's quite as significant to us. I don't think that, like, we live and die on fourth place as much. I don't think top four is our everything, Lindy.
I can see that from the Conte factor.
Yeah.
But I don't think Kane stays if we don't qualify for the Champions League.
Oh boy, let's not end the podcast there. Quick, say something.
But I think we're going to get top four. I honestly feel really good about it still. As you pointed out earlier, the underlying numbers are really, really good, trending in the right direction across Conte's tenureship. Certainly from looking at the start of the season under Nuno to where we are now, it's light and dark. There's a huge difference. Even just watching the games, you can see we're a much more threatening team at the moment. We do have some lapses at the back that we need to be a little bit concerned about, but there's a lot of good stuff happening. We've now got Kulusevski, who looks a genuinely excellent signing. Hopefully we'll have some midfielders back fit soon to give us a few more options. And of course, Romero and Dyer are back and playing really well. So I think there's lots of reasons to be positive about the run-in. It'd be great to beat Borough as well and still have the sort of FA Cup going on in the background. Wouldn't it be wonderful to win a trophy? But I do feel good about top four still.
You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Bardi for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindmer for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at Davey Shambles and his SoundCloud, E. Lindmer. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.